Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. My wife Katie and I just had a couple of whirlwind weeks here in Beijing, China, with first her parents visiting us, and then as soon as they left, we had a couple of friends come and visit here. And while our friends Matt and Jess were here, we spent a few days at the Great Wall. First, Matt, Jess, and I went rock climbing with a view of the wall in the background. That was an awesome day. And then the following day, all four of us went hiking, first starting in Mutianyu and then hiking all the way to Jianko. It was a beautiful day out on the wall, blue skies, and everything was blooming. It's springtime here in Beijing. And we ended our day by camping right on the Great Wall of China, and we made dinner and the sun went down. And after all of that, all of our regular duties were done for the day, Matt and I sat down on the wall itself and recorded this podcast. We were overlooking this valley of Jianko with the nearby city of Huairou's lights glimmering in the background. And on the other side of us, there was the tiny village of Shijiazi down in this valley. It was a really cool setting to record a podcast. And all things considered, I think things went really well. We were very tired and getting ready for bed, but we managed to stay awake somehow for a solid hour of great conversation about travel. The only kind of technical issue we ran into was wind noise, which actually doesn't sound all that bad. I was thinking it would sound a lot worse. It kind of sounds like an avalanche coming, so fear not, my friends. We were totally fine. It was just a bit of wind blowing. Matthew is an interesting character. I think it will become abundantly clear as you listen to the show that he is highly conscientious of how he's affecting the environment around him and even how the environment around him affects him as he travels through this world. But before I get into my conversation with Matthew, I just want to say thank you for listening, and I plan to continue recording the show. And kind of my idea for this is that I'm going to travel the world, or travel Asia anyway, for the next year or so with my wife, Katie, and I hope to meet lots of interesting and fun characters wherever I go and have conversations with them, get their take on what travel means to them, and listen to some locals and how they view the world. So if you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you would give me a review on iTunes or simply just tell a friend about it. Thanks again for all of your support, and let's jump into my conversation with Matthew Clausen.
I hope we can get through this whole podcast without me falling asleep.
No.
Because I am pretty tired right now. It's dark out, and we're sitting here on the Great Wall of China.
Yeah. Got here on, our seventh day in China? My seventh day in China, I think.
It's been that long? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because
sixth day. It's your sixth day.
Because we've...
Oh, you lost a day in your flight, if you count that day.
We left on a Saturday, Central Standard Time, arrived on a Sunday.
Right. It's always a little weird
Beijing
coming
time.
Both directions. It's weird because when you go from Chicago to Beijing, you lose a whole day and you basically land at the same time, but the next day.
And it's a 14-hour flight that's 24 hours
exactly
later when you land.
Yeah. But then when you go home, you get back a little bit before you left usually.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird. You sit on this plane for so long and then get off the plane and then it's still light out and it's the same day. And it messes with your head a little bit.
Totally gonna mess in my sleep.
Yeah. How are you guys doing on jet lag?
We both keep waking up around sometime between 3 and 5 a.m. And not being able to get back to sleep after that, and then usually waking up once or twice in the middle of the night to
Yeah, that's normal. Has it been getting better?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I'm not falling asleep at 8 p.m. anymore.
So. Yeah, that's good. Well, for me, it's not the falling asleep at 8 that bothers me with jet lag. It's the waking up at 3. Yeah.
And being like, whoa.
And then I'm wide awake. The cool thing about that, though, is that I can get a lot of stuff done because everybody else is asleep.
Yeah.
So no
I try to fool myself that I'm going to be able to fall back asleep if I just lay there quietly and don't move. And then my body will be like, oh, no, I should be asleep, and I'm going to fix this jet lag thing tonight.
It happens that way?
No.
it doesn't actually work. You just think it will.
Yeah. Wishful thinking is all.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I remember even like a month after moving to Beijing, I would just start falling asleep. Like, let's say it was 11 at night. I'd be kind of just on my way down, and then I would go, it's daytime. Or like in my head, I'd say like, it's 9 a.m., and I'm supposed to be awake, and I'd wake right back up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a jet lag thing necessarily, just like a mental thing. Like, the internet kind of ruins it. Because you know, before I go to bed, I like go online, check the news, and oh, the stock market's open. Oh, let's see how that's doing. There's news coming in from the U.S. And it's just, we always are so up to date, or we can just get this info anytime we want.
And there's always more of it.
And there's always new stuff. But then during our day here, the news from the U.S. Kind of goes into a lag because everybody's asleep. So there's usually not anything really much happening, getting updated anyway.
Yeah.
It's always like early morning and late at night that I can get my fix or whatever.
Where it feels freshest and newest.
Yeah. It is like the internet's changed so much, but it's like changed everything with travel. I mean, I get all my news online, and it think about 20 years ago, if you were in China, you wouldn't have any clue what's happening at home.
Or what's happening where you're about to go.
Oh yeah, even there. Right. I mean, even closer places.
Yeah. And staying in touch with people in places where you have been. The internet is, in some ways it's taken the mystery out. In other ways it's just made it a lot easier.
It's true. It's made it has kind of ruined, not ruined, but you know what I mean? Like, eroded travel a little bit, maybe, like your experience.
Each adventure's a little less adventuresome.
Yeah, and you have to go, like, further and further away to really get out there and feel like you're in the real world and not the online world.
And the interdependency that it enables, I mean, I think you have cell phone coverage here.
Oh, I definitely do,
We're looking at Beijing. I'm pretty sure the cell phone towers were our line of sight for us.
Well, it's not actually Beijing.
Oh.
It looks like a massive city, but that's just Huairou, which is like not even a suburb of Beijing. It's just this little city that we passed through. It's probably, I don't know, 500,000 people.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, it's just tiny. And then there's a couple actual proper villages in this valley here.
Yeah.
That it's cool. Like, once you cross this mountain range coming away from Beijing, you really do feel like you're out there, like in a little village or away from people here and there anyway.
I can also see 6 airplanes moving through the smog.
All at once?
7, yeah. Sorry, 7.
Oh, is the smog coming back?
Yeah.
Well.
The wind's died down a bit.
Yeah.
But overhead we have the stars.
Yeah, it's still not too bad. Maybe a little bit of pollution. But this village behind us is pretty special for Katie and me. Like, this is kind of our first place that we came when we moved to China, where it's like we got away from people. Like, this was our first successful attempt.
Yeah.
That's, and it's so, I mean, it's still a village, there's still our people, but
it has history for you. And it, like, it does. This is your fifth time coming to the village?
Fourth or fifth. I've lost track. I mean, I've done different things here. Like, it's always Great Wall related because the village is right next to the Great Wall. We've gone like hiking a couple different areas around here.
That brings up a question I have for you when it comes to travel.
Mm-hmm.
The going someplace you've already been, alluring or not so much?
It gets like less adrenaline pumping, you know, with each time.
Yeah.
But when I'm with friends who haven't seen it, I also kind of like being the tour guide at times. And so it's kind of fun. It's not how I want to travel all the time. I'm not that guy that's just going to go to like a timeshare or something. Like, that would be awful for me. Like, just the same spot every year. I definitely don't like that. but I will come back to some places, especially a really cool place like the Great Wall, and like this is an unrestored section. There's just, you know, we're really like undisturbed here, I hope. We are camping on the wall, which we're not supposed to be doing, but I think we're good. Night has fallen and no one has bothered us yet.
And locals showed you where to camp here when your time's out of thought?
Yeah, it's a little confusing, and maybe you could say nerve-wracking as a traveler in China, because like in America or the United States, we have rules, and rules are rules. Like, there's not many like gray areas with rules. I mean, maybe you could say the speed limit is kind of one.
Yeah.
Like, the speed limit says 55. Okay, if you're going 60, you're probably fine. That'd be an example.
Yeah.
But China has many, many more of these. And just...
That are not actively enforced or policed?
Not enforced. No one cares. Until they do, that's the scary part. Like, when is it that you're crossing a line and you're actually doing something bad?
Yeah.
Because, like, you're doing 10 illegal things all the time, and, you know?
Yeah.
From, like... Well, I don't know what the rules on like jaywalking say, but the only way to get across the road is a jaywalk. You have to,
you know, or vehicles going in the different directions on one lane parts of the road.
The wrong way. It's 100% normal here to go the wrong way on a one-way road here, or
biking down the bike path with an electric scooter coming at you head on.
Oh yeah, yeah. The traffic here is kind of nuts. Have you guys been doing all right with it? Like, we've been biking like everywhere. We haven't even gotten into a proper taxi or in the subway yet.
So we've done the tourist bit, like Temple of Heaven and the Lama Temple and some other sites. But for me, one of the most memorable and personally enjoyable parts is actually when we were coming back from Temple of Heaven and the cycling. I enjoy biking myself just in general. And like that felt more like getting to know a place than going to Temple of Heaven.
Oh, okay, that's good to hear.
Biking back during rush hour in Beijing,
I can see that. Yeah,
yeah. It, one, like the sort of some of the adrenaline and the exertion of it put me in the moment, put me in the present, brought me like focused on the now, which is something I sometimes struggle with.
Oh yeah, well. Happens to us all, right? Yeah. I mean,
so it has that aspect of the focus on the now, but at the same time, experiencing something that this sounds silly, but experiencing something that most people find inane, but in a very different cultural context, is enlightening to me, because it's everybody experiences rush hour if they're living anywhere near a city. But how they experience rush hour and what they take for granted and those little habits of life is something that I find very interesting when I travel.
Yeah, that's good. That's an interesting point. I mean, sometimes when you're traveling, you can just do like normal everyday stuff.
Yeah.
And it's cool. It's like, oh, that's how they do it here, huh?
Yeah.
Like Jess and I went grocery shopping.
Yeah.
And like we went to this market, and I've gone there like 20 times because it's this really big market with fruit, vegetables, like meat, seafood, everything you could possibly want that's available in Beijing anyway. And prices tend to be cheap, and that's kind of why we go there. And I kind of forgot how interesting it is if you haven't been to China before,
because
there's all these open air stalls and people selling their really highly, pretty much all of them sell like highly specialized things. Like this lady sells chicken and chicken only.
Yeah.
And this person sells beef. And then you've got like bandsaws going and like cutting the beef apart. And, you know, you can see the oxtails like that have been stripped of their skin and just hanging there with the meat. And
that is definitely, through traveling, that's something that I've come to appreciate. I grew up farming. Back up a little bit. I grew up farming a bit. Beef farm and some cereal grains. When I went to college, I genuinely met people who genuinely felt that like food comes in plastic and that's just where it comes from. I was having a conversation with somebody once who was eating a hamburger when I shared that I grew up on a beef farm, and yeah, we had to, you know, the beef were sent to slaughter and people eat it. And well, in the midst of a bite, this she looked at me and goes, oh, you're kidding. That's terrible. You killed the cows? Like, you're eating a hamburger.
And while she's presently eating a hamburger.
Yeah.
Did she just not know that it was really a cow?
Or? I called it out. And she's like, well, that's different. That comes in plastic.
So maybe she really didn't realize that it was a dead animal?
Or? I don't know. We're all in college, so I'm pretty sure that they know how the circle of life works. And that beef is, you know, dead animal. But the disconnect between knowing something the disconnect between knowing something as a fact and knowing something in your life can be a jump, I think, cognitively for for all of us sometimes.
Yeah.
So knowing a fact versus incorporating that fact in your life and knowing it as a lived experience can be different. The idea that I know animals die so that we can eat their flesh, and the lived experience of I am taking a bite and eating the flesh of something that was once alive.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. And we do our best to like cover it all up and just sanitize it.
Yeah.
And it's less so in China, for sure. Our relationship with food is kind
just
of bizarre.
About everywhere outside the US.
That's true.
People have a much tighter connection with their food and that lived experience of where their food comes from.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that.
With me, I remember when it hit me.
Yeah.
With I wasn't quite as extreme as this friend of yours, but I was in Ecuador and on a bus, and we kind of stopped at like a red light or something. And next to us was this outdoor food stall, and they had a whole pig on like a spit, like turning.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was just done. It was just done cooking, but it was still in pig form.
Yes. Yeah. It still looks like a pig.
It still looked like a pig. And this girl came up to the pig with a fork, and she stuck the fork in the pig's back, took out a piece of flesh, and started eating it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's nasty. Why would you do that? You're sticking your fork right in the pig. And then I realized, like, oh, wait a minute. How's that any different from, like, what I normally eat?
Yeah.
Like, if I eat pork. Huh.
From all those pulled pork sandwiches and the neatly sliced, wrapped pieces of pork that we've had.
That's right.
Ham. Sliced ham.
Yeah, one thing here is they'll eat anything in China. Yeah. And so there's a lot of organs out. It's not just meat. And organs are a delicacy in a lot of dishes here.
Yeah, it's not a culture that wastes food.
No, not so much. I mean, who knows what's going to happen, you know, in the future as the economy improves. I mean, are they going to become more like the West? But, you keep in mind, is anytime you see food here and if you think something's weird, like what they eat, like keep in mind, man, like 60 years ago, there were people starving here.
Yeah.
And when you're starving, you'll eat anything.
But when I was in Cambodia, that was something like they talked about the fried tarantula and like there are some places that offered it for tourists or had it on a menu, and I was talking to somebody about, you know, is this really considered a delicacy? And because it just tastes like fried crisp nothing.
Right.
Like, it's like imagine a tasteless Frito that's really small.
No, it doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah, like it's just a crispy fried thing.
Right.
Like, is this really a delicacy, or what? Why do people enjoy it? And said, well, no, we don't really enjoy it. It's, you know, Cambodia went through the Khmer Rouge and everything, and they were eating spiders because that's all they had to eat. And then it just sort of, you know, they still offer it sometimes, but it's not really a delicacy.
Right. Yeah. They like whatever they could find.
Yeah.
I mean, that was more recent even, you know, that was like the 70s and into the early 80s, I think.
Yes.
God. So I went there just for like a week or so, and I'd seen like the killing fields and the prison there, that, what is it? S21, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. Man.
Oh, that was so sad. But it's kind of like another thing that related to what you're saying with food.
Yeah.
With this disconnect that it's completely understandable, but this happens to all of us, between reading about something in a book and like really experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I really experienced these places, but seeing them drove it home. Like, wow, this really happened. You know,
Yeah.
What do they kill, like 20% of their population?
Huge number. I mean, and you know, we'll never really know.
Yeah, giant. And going into the killing fields and seeing like that giant pile of skulls, of human skulls, it's really morbid, but it's just their history.
It's the saddest I've ever been when traveling.
Really? Yeah, I was super sad too. When the killing fields,
I stopped traveling internationally for about 2 years after Cambodia.
Because of that?
I don't know if it's right or not, but I felt really guilty. Hmm. Showing up as a tourist to something like that. I mean, I think it's important to bear witness to what happened. But in Cambodia, between the killing fields and Tonle Sap, children were on display holding snakes for photo opportunities for tourists to, like, just making them, kids would walk around holding giant snakes. I don't know if you saw that.
I never saw that one. Just so you'd hold the snake and take a picture with it?
No, you'd take a picture of them holding these giant snakes. And apparently, the mouths were sewn shut on the snakes by their parents or whatever.
Oh, right.
Like, this, and just seeing, like, the...
So you've got like animal abuse there and exploitation of people, and I know, and like with that kind of thing, it so quickly can turn into, oh, that's the best way to make money.
Yeah.
So let's all do it.
And
much easier than working in a field.
Yeah.
Just go out and hold the snake up.
And it only works because people like me were showing up and walking through there.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I felt really.
And then it can get worse because you go home, or whoever goes home and shows people their pictures. Oh, wow, that looks cool. I want to go there now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it happens like in Peru, Bolivia too. But I think especially Peru around Cusco is where I've seen this the most. Like people holding a little lamb or holding a llama or an alpaca or walking with one.
Yeah.
And... like, hey, can you pay me some money to get a picture?
Yeah. And two are shoving the camera in their face, and then they hold their hand out.
You know, right, yeah, dala, that kind
dala,
of thing.
Dala.
Yeah. I actually wrote about that experience in my book, 1,000 Days Between.
Yeah?
Yeah. There was one of my first days in Peru, and I did it. I didn't really think about it at the time. I just thought, oh, wow, that looks cool. Uh-huh. But it wasn't me taking a picture of her. It was me with two alpacas at my sides.
Okay.
And when I was, when my friend was taking the picture just before it, I like yanked one of the alpacas closer to me to kind of like line it up.
Oh.
And all of a sudden I heard this. It sounded just like a person. I swear it sounded like the. And I kind of like turned my head, and before I knew what was going on, spat right across my face.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that thing was pissed. And then like, and there were like, as is quite often the case in these places, there was a nice circle of local people like that just happened to be there laughing at me. Like, look at this stupid foreigner getting spat on. I mean, I guess I had heard that camels can spit, like, before that. I didn't realize alpacas
spit. I've also heard that camels don't spit. I don't know if it's a myth or not, but yeah, llamas do. Alpacas spit.
I can definitely confirm that alpacas spit.
Yeah.
And they are, like, cousins of the camel.
Yeah.
Like the camelids. So, I don't know if camels really can spit, but I had never heard about these South American camelids spitting.
They don't do the attitude, yeah.
No.
But, yeah.
The photo thing is a tough one, though.
We experienced that today. Like, two white face, like, we four people here with our white faces walking the Great Wall and getting camera shoved in our face.
Sure, sure. I mean, I'm pretty used to that, like, being here, because I've been here, like, almost close to 3 years now, and... I get what you're saying because you're brand new here.
Yeah.
But just me being white and tall and, you know, having long hair and a beard, all these things just make me really, really stand out in China. And people come up and want my picture all the time. But I wouldn't think of charging them money.
Right. That is a different level of it.
It's a different thing. Like, I guess when they, like, come up and talk to me, and, you know, we had these guys come up and ask where we're from, and
right.
then they said, like, oh, let's get a photo with our American friends, and, you know, that was kind of cool. It's like, oh, yeah. I mean, you didn't understand any of it, but...
I got the gist.
But it was, like, they were really nice guys, and a lot of the time they'll ask, like, can I get your picture? And I'll, personally, I always say yes. I know some people who say no, and I don't fault them for it.
Yeah.
But when it bothers me is when someone just walks right up to me, like this guy was trying to do today, literally 1 foot from my face with their phone, trying to take my picture without making eye contact with me, without saying hi to me.
Yeah. Just staring at the screen.
Yeah. Like I'm a rock. Like they just like walk up to the rock, take a picture of it. Oh, the rock walked away. Why? Oh, I'm disappointed now. I didn't get a photo of it.
Yeah, you know? I was waiting to get into one of the guard towers. I was climbing in behind another guy, and there was a woman who stuck her phone down as I'm trying to climb in, so she'd take pictures of me climbing into the guard tower and everything. And it's like,
yeah,
oh, that's awkward. But then her friends wanted to, they asked me if I'd take a picture with them, and I said, yeah, but I think it's kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, you get more used to it as you as you've been here longer and longer, and it doesn't happen that much in the city.
Yeah,
it happens more when we go to places where there's tourists from smaller cities or villages where they don't really see foreigners. Because I don't know specifically where they were from, but some people, especially if I go, like we were in Temple of Heaven.
Yeah,
and that's one of the top tourist spots in Beijing. Some people there are. It's their first time in Beijing, and they're Chinese. They're from far away. And they've literally, some of them have never seen a foreigner in their entire lives. I'm sure of it. Until they came to Beijing.
Yeah.
And so it's like a really cool thing for them.
I'd like to just interrupt for a moment and say, we are sitting on top of the Great Wall, and I don't know if the microphone picked it up, but there's an owl out there hooting.
There is
in
one.
In the forest below us.
Yeah, I doubt we can hear it because it's behind the recording device.
But, okay.
Well, we can confirm that it is a cool sound.
And there's either a dog or coyote off behind us on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, the sound is really carrying here.
Yeah.
That's cool. Like at night, for some reason, it seems to carry so much more.
Yeah. And we've got two valleys, one in front of us and one behind us. And...
Yeah, it's wonderful. We spent all day hiking today.
Yeah.
And
it's good.
Yeah, what did you think of it? Of today?
Today I thought was really good. I had all these weird misconceptions about the Great Wall from grade school when I first learned of it.
Yeah.
And it was really cool getting out here. And it is a great engineering feat for their time. And two, it's not quite like what I was taught in grade school. It's not huge. Like I had this picture in my head of like a four-lane highway-sized wall with all these perfectly stacked blocks, and
and
totally
like
wrong.
30 feet tall or something.
Yeah, right, yeah, like right. This huge wall. And I'd seen some other people's photos who'd gone to like the really touristy sections of the walls where they've been rebuilt.
Yep.
Where everything fits together nicely and smooth, and we saw a little bit of that early on in the hike, but then we got into the actual wall, and you can see how it was built, and then rebuilt, and then some stuff added onto it, and there are sections that are, you know, still mortared together a bit, but most of it's crumbling, and just. Seeing it as a, I don't know, almost as a living thing, the wall, it ages.
I like that. Yeah.
It grows old and it decays. Like.
Yeah, it is decaying, and it won't be here forever.
And it's.
Neither will we. It's kind of a reminder, you know.
Yeah.
It's all decaying.
And in some sections, it's only as wide as a footpath. And in other sections, I mean, you got like maybe a two-lane road.
We're sitting now, we're on like the width of a two-lane road.
Yeah, but then 40 feet off to our right, half of it's fallen down the side of a mountain.
Yeah, you'll see that a lot, collapsed sections, and you kind of have to do a balancing act here and there to get across.
Yeah. And some of the steeper sections where all the stairs have eroded out, it's interesting. It's interesting because the parts that we climb down on, we're doing some rock climbing, some down climbing, on rocks that are mortared together in there, and it was the fill underneath the wall. The paving stones on top for most of the wall, that where that's eroded away in the steepest parts, you still see chunks of rock that were broken up and mortared together as fill beneath the wall to give it height.
Right. It looks like they just kind of chiseled out some rocks from the mountain.
Yeah.
And then lifted them up to the top of the mountain. Like,
oh, that's for the blocks that fit together nicely and the sides of the wall itself. But in some sections, like we had the wall on either side that was crumbly or still standing in some cases. But the middle of the road, as it were.
Oh, I get it.
The path we were going down is all eroded out, and the stairs are gone.
Yeah.
For those steep sections. And underneath where those stairs would have been, there remains the chunks of rock that weren't shaped. And I could see mortar holding it together.
In the middle. Oh,
yeah,
I see.
It wasn't all live rock that we were down climbing on. Some of it was. And some of it were rocks that were mortared together.
Got it. Yeah, I kind of assumed that was all just original rock. Huh. I mean, it was kind of cool for me, like, because I do at least some rock climbing here and there. Yeah. I used to be more active with it. But all the, like, flakes that you can find sticking up, that it's just, there's a lot of really good handholds and footholds. And, I mean, it's
beautiful.
It's not like proper rock climbing.
It was class 5. You had all four hands on.
So there was some low fifth class stuff.
Yeah. Maybe like 5'2", 5'3", maybe a move of 5'4" when it got spicy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some parts were a little bit exposed, you know, like some parts you're like, there's almost a 0% chance of me falling, but you really don't want to fall here.
Yeah. Like nothing was super sketchy.
Nah.
It wasn't like you're down climbing a chalk pile.
Right.
But you're right on the exposure as well. And that was really cool.
Yeah, I've taken a few other people here and I knew you guys would be fine because you're rock climbers, but it can really freak people out. Like,
oh,
they can,
I imagine.
Yeah, they can get sketched out on stuff like that. Not because it's like physically that challenging. It's just, it's kind of scary when you look down and you've got about a, you know, 20-foot drop.
Yeah, there's no safety net.
No.
It's just you.
Right. It's like a, you know, low-end boulder problem almost, that's, you know, 20, 30 feet high sometimes.
Yeah. It's not hard to do. It's just staying focused as you do it.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you had your in-the-moment moments with your biking in the city, and you had some focus here, some little bit of that. A lot of hiking today. I mean, we can still see where we started from, but we did this giant kind of loop pattern. So
the aqueduct down there?
Yeah, we started from this aqueduct, hiked up to a village, hiked along the wall, and now we're... This part of the wall, I can't remember if it's like 300 years old or maybe a little older. It's not like thousands of years old.
Yeah.
But it also is original. So that's what makes it so cool. It hasn't been restored at all. There's no guardrails. There is one guy selling beer. There is that. But that actually, we actually like that because...
And access to his ladder.
Oh, right. He's selling access to his ladder. It's not his ladder. It's just a ladder. That's the other thing. He'll charge you money to climb down a ladder that's just leaning against the Great Wall.
Yeah, pro tip. Everywhere you see a ladder and somebody who's going to charge you for it, there's another way around that doesn't cost any money.
Yeah, there you go. You can always do it.
Look for the ribbons tied in the trees. That's the path.
Oh, right. Well, there's the Beijing... hikers group, I think it's called.
Yeah, I think I met some of them up there because they had me hold a flag with them while they took a picture with me, and they were, I have no idea what the writing was on the flag, but it had the picture of two people with backpacks hiking.
Oh, it did?
Yeah. So okay. I'm going to guess that they're members of the club.
Were they all Chinese?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. And they were part of a pretty big group.
Okay. It could have been them. The Beijing hikers usually attract some Chinese, but it's more foreign people.
Oh.
But they're like this outdoor club. I think they're probably for profit though, because they charge a lot of money for their hikes, and a lot of it's stuff that you could just get to by like public transportation and just go walk on a trail.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of people just don't want to dick around with like figuring out how the buses work, and they just want to. You know, a lot of people when they go away for the weekend or on a day or 2 day trip, they just want to get outside and not think about work, not think about anything.
Yeah.
And the way I typically will travel, I have to do a lot of planning and logistics just before I've even like set foot outside. And so I get it. Like, you know, you don't have a lot of time on your hands. You just want to be outside.
That's a great point. The amount of planning that goes before a trip, like you and I differ on that. When I'm going on vacation, I like to have a plane ticket in and a plane ticket out, mm-hmm. and then figure out the rest while I'm there and just sort of flow.
Okay.
A lot of people are really uncomfortable with that.
Oh, well, so far we're on the same page. Except maybe the plane ticket out thing. I like to have just a plane ticket in.
I thought you were saying just now that you plan out the logistics a lot.
Oh, okay. I get what you're saying. I think of travel more as a long-term thing. And so I like to plan maybe for months at a time rather than like each day.
Oh, I see. You plan the big picture.
Yeah, maybe like, yeah, this month I'll be here, this month I'll be here. But not like this day I'll be here until it's like tomorrow.
Yeah.
But to go on a hike, I kind of actually like all the, like you do have to do planning. You can do it one of two ways.
Yeah.
You know, you can either hire a guide and they'll do everything for you.
Yeah.
Or do it on your own. And if you do it on your own, there's just a certain amount of planning that goes into that hike.
Yeah.
So not that I want every moment of every day to be planned. It's not like that. It's just, I think I'd rather do the logistics for hikes like this without paying someone and without a guide.
Well, you did a great job with logistics.
Oh, thank
right
you.
Down to all the bus lines and everything.
Thank you. You know, I'm starting to like get it, you know.
Yeah.
I'd say it's about a year into living in China, I could like figure out how to use their buses.
If you hadn't been looking at your phone, I would have thought you were doing it like a native.
Oh,
right.
You right.
had those bus lines pretty pat.
Yeah, even they do look at their phone sometimes. But
I'm just messing with you.
Yeah, I know. But like, if you're thinking of coming to China, like the subways now, those are, you haven't even used those.
No.
But, day one, if you don't speak any Chinese at all, you can come in and use the subway.
Right.
Because there's signs in English everywhere. And every time they make an announcement, like, the next stop is, they'll make that in both Chinese and in English.
Oh, we did take the subway from the airport.
Oh, the airport express.
To your apartment, yeah.
Right.
Barely counts.
Yeah, I guess that counts. It's connected to the greater subway system.
It's pretty much a straight line.
Yeah, it's just one special line from the airport into the city that makes it easy to get in.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can pretty much use the subway from day one, but the buses, man, the signs are all these metal signs and everything's in Chinese.
Yeah.
You can kind of gather when the bus starts running. And
it shows the bus numbers in Roman numeral, not Roman, in letter.
Arabic, I think they call it Arabic numerals.
In yeah. Arabic numerals, but apparently it doesn't show all of the bus lines. Because we saw buses coming through that weren't on those signs.
Right. So sometimes that'll happen. And it doesn't tell you how often that bus comes.
Yeah.
And some buses only come a couple times a day. And some of them are like every 10 minutes. And there's no schedule. Like, okay, we're from a smaller city or live there. I used to live there in Madison.
Yeah. Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin. So you could get a book, and I guess now it's probably on your phone, but a book of timetables, and it'll say at 8:05 this bus comes to this stop.
It's and like, it'll be there at 8:05.
Yeah, it's really precise.
It might be there at 8:05 and 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But it's going to be there.
Within 1 minute of when it says. Yeah. And if the driver gets there a little early, he'll probably just wait.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, to catch it up.
Yep.
So it's really accurate, which is nice. It's a little anal, but it's nice. if you're trying to catch a bus, But in China, there's no schedule, so they'll just come when they come.
Yeah.
And you just stand around. The subway, though, they'll tell you the next train is in 3 minutes or whatever.
Hmm.
Not always, but usually. It's really, subway's really well done here. That's one thing, that's kind of another thing. I'd rather, related to what we were saying, I'd rather figure out the public transportation system wherever I go. I'm not really a fan of taxis.
Yeah,
and
I feel you on that.
It was tough when we first moved here with taxis, especially because none of the taxi drivers speak English. It's, or almost none. It's a very rare time when you just stop a random taxi, like a city taxi, and the driver can speak any English at all. Extremely rare. And a lot of the time, they're not even like Beijingers. I heard a story of a guy who was, he came into the airport. I'm pretty sure this is really true. He flew into Beijing. He got in the taxi and he said, take me to Dongzhimen, and which is like the one of the most common neighborhoods or busiest neighborhoods in Beijing. Like everyone knows Dongzhimen. And he said, I don't know, where is that? and the guy said, well, wait a minute, how long have you been in Beijing? And he said, oh, I just got here yesterday.
That sounds like the Uber driver I had in Chicago last time I got an Uber.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, it wasn't a language barrier thing. He just moved there and had no idea where he was driving. He was trying to use the GPS and it didn't work in all the tall buildings.
Oh, wow.
We were driving in circles and it was like, no, this isn't right. We got to get to the train station.
Oh, my God. It's really rough in China when, like, there's no GPS in the taxis.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the drivers tend to have smartphones, but if you can't, like, communicate with them where you're going, it, like, how do you even get anywhere? Like, I can maybe just say, like, go straight, go left, go right, but that, I can kind of do that because I know the layout of the city now.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to get, especially if I had to get to a, like, a restaurant where they have an English name and a Chinese name.
Yeah.
When I first moved here, I didn't speak Chinese, so I would learn the English name of the restaurant, tell him that. There's no way he's going to know that, though. He's only going to know the Chinese name. And so now we have a big problem.
Yes.
And I don't know how to figure that out. So it was quite stressful. But I will say it helps with, like, learning the language, too.
You've done well at that.
Thanks. I still have a ways to go. But putting yourself into a stressful situation, although I hated it at the time, it, like, I admit it, like, solidifies a lot of words in my brain.
I think this touches on two things that I'm fascinated by. One, travel, and the other, learning, human learning. And yeah, a little stress, like struggle, makes learning stick. I do training sometimes for business training, and I tell them at the start of it, hey, I will give you the printed notes at the end of this. I'm not going to do a whole lot on the slides, but I'll give you the printed slides at the end of this. But I'm not going to give them to you up front. And it's because a bit of suffering makes you remember and retain the information better if you need to critically think and engage with it rather than having it already printed in front of you.
Huh.
And people tend to get it, but the same thing with traveling, like a bit of suffering when you travel, I think really helps you learn more about where you've gone, what that place is like, and then retain those memories when you come home.
Oh, it helps you remember things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
like, do you remember your trips where everything went right?
Less, you're right. I think you're definitely right.
Yeah.
Like, you go away for a week and nothing bad happens and it just starts to blur together.
Yeah, I remember I went there, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Day to day, nah.
When there's a problem.
Yeah.
And you gotta solve it.
Right.
That's the adventure, that's the story, that's the thing that sticks.
That totally is. And so, like, when you're doing this with, what was it, your students or
they're adult learners. I wouldn't call them students, but I consult with businesses sometimes for marketing and business training.
Okay. Oh, so when you're kind of triggering this, the way you do it is by not giving them all the notes, this suffering?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I tell them, I'm going to be talking, I'm going to be showing you things, we'll be doing hands-on work, and you all have paper in front of you and something to write with.
Yeah.
And I want you to go through that exercise of writing it down and being a bit stressed over, am I going to remember this?
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, there is that, like, I guess you could call it a meme or this thing that people say that I don't know if it's really true. It's probably not. But where they say, like, you remember, like, 5% of what you just heard and, like, 50% of what... I don't remember the numbers even.
I'm not familiar. Yeah.
It's kind of ironic that I can't remember this.
Apparently you only heard it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's why I don't remember it. Oh, I didn't think about that. So it's not ironic at all.
You didn't have to write it down.
It's exactly what you'd expect. But then, yeah, you get to, like, writing down is, like, 75%, and then, like, stuff that you teach to others is the most. Then you remember, like, 90%. But how... I mean, that's so generalized, like... I don't know if that's based on any studies or anything.
I don't know if I'd put much stock in the numbers, but I think the directional value of it is true.
It's a good rule of thumb. Like, once you teach things to others, I think if you... There's this other saying, if you can teach it to a five-year-old, then you know it.
Yeah.
Like, once you can do that.
If you can teach it correctly to a five-year-old.
And get them to, like, understand it.
Let's put a caveat in there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess you could just, like, bullshit your way through it, but lie to a five-year-old. That's easy to do.
I got a question for you. So, climbing.
Yeah.
There's when I was first getting into climbing, and it was only about, I guess, 6 years ago, maybe only five. And I took a course with a guy for lead climbing, and he expressed how he gets upset when friends are showing friends how to lead climb. Because it's a serious matter, and he felt only somebody who's an expert at it and has really established themselves should ever show somebody else how to lead climb, because they're taking on a huge responsibility as a teacher.
Yeah, it's also very important that you pay him money.
It's also important to pay him. But at the same time, like, it's true. When you teach somebody else, even if you're not teaching it perfectly, you're learning it much better yourself.
Hmm.
I think there's a disclosure aspect in there that makes it, that overcomes his ethical concern. Like, so long as you're straightforward with your friend or whoever it is you're teaching, like, hey, I'm not an expert, I'm still learning this too, so call me out as I'm working on it or something doesn't make sense.
Right.
Let's do this together. I think when there's that disclosure, it's great that...
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you're not... If you're learning how to lead climb, which, yeah, it is more dangerous than top rope climbing, and it is another step up, and you do have to, like, you know, be serious. Like, you're not going to be sitting buddy-buddy, like, having a beer with someone while you're doing this. You kind of have to put on a different hat and, like, different mode of thinking.
Yeah.
But as long as you can, like, as long as you're not one of those guys who's always in the same mood, like messing around all the time, you know, then, and you can actually be serious for a minute. Yeah, I agree. I think there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with friends teaching friends how to climb, how to lead climb.
or anything, like how to travel, how to get around a city, how to, you know.
Sure. I mean, like,
the climbing was the example where...
Yeah, I see what you mean.
I think that principle in, like, teaching others, like, if there's something you love, something you care about, or something you want to get better at, find somebody else who wants to learn about it. Find somebody else who's also interested in, basically take turns teaching each other, I think.
Teach each other, too. That's a good one. Huh.
Oh, yeah, because, people are always going to know... Two perspectives is going to give you more insight than just one.
That's true. I mean, and with, you know, back to just climbing specifically, I mean, I came up with climbing through the Hoofers in Madison.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Like the Outing Club and the Mountaineering Club. And I mean, especially with the Outing Club, I would take brand new people all the time and teach them how to climb. And
yeah.
I'm not how to lead climb necessarily, but teach them how to tie in and, like, how to check safety and...
Yeah, check an anchor, maybe even build an anchor.
Did
you do any anchor building clinics?
I don't think I never ran one. I've learned how to do it.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I formally took one with the Hoofers, but that's an important thing.
Yeah.
And, well, for people who don't know, when you're climbing, you can set up it's called a top rope from the top of a cliff. And we have to do this where we usually climb at Devil's Lake. It's a long, drawn-out thing. I don't want to get into it entirely. But you have to set it up so that the rope is safe and it won't fall. And it's a really important thing, because it is, like, you know, you're putting you're putting your life in your hands and other people's lives in your hands.
Yeah.
And so I was, I was pretty afraid. I remember the first time I set one, but as long as I had somebody come and verify it and make sure it looks good, and then I'd feel okay to maybe rappel off of it and test it out a little bit.
Yeah. I think that, just incorporating that teaching. The reason I said also teaching each other is that aspect of humility. I think that, I think every human being is a terrible student so long as they have pride blocking.
Oh yeah,
blocking
big time.
Their mind. Like going into something feeling like, all right, I already know, or I know better, or I know everything there is to know, or even just I may not know it all, but they don't have anything to teach me. It builds a wall bigger than the Great Wall on your brain.
Good one, for sure.
It just shuts down your opportunity for growing. Because like 90% of what they say might not be new to you. But this goes back again to knowing a fact and living that knowledge, having a lived experience. Sometimes you may know it even, but hearing somebody else say it or put it in the context of their own life could be that time that really makes it click and stand out in your memory, and that you get it and imbibe it.
So it's important to listen.
Yeah. And then there's going to be that 10% where you never thought of it and you're like, oh, well, I should have thought of that.
Going to each day trying to learn new things.
Yeah.
Do you know the Dunning-Kruger effect?
No.
Oh, this is, it's almost a little bit of what you're getting at. Beginners tend to greatly overestimate.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you do know, they tend to overestimate their ability in a thing, whatever the thing is. And so you start out like knowing nothing. And if someone asks how much do you know about it, like you'll just say nothing.
Yeah.
But you learn a little bit and suddenly you're an expert and like you think you are.
Right.
And in studies, like if you ask someone how good they think they are, it could be chess, it could be playing a sport or something. I don't know, it could be some like computer related, whatever it is, any skill that you're picking up, maybe it's rock climbing. You tend to like think that you're getting pretty good at it.
Yeah, and then they'll express overconfidence in their own ability.
Right, right.
Their own set of knowledge.
Overconfidence. And you have to be careful of that because it will hold you back from learning. You have to keep that humility. Yeah.
And isn't there another step in this on that scale?
Yeah, then the curve goes, it's like knowledge versus what you think you know. And so at first you know very little, you think you know a lot. Then you continue to learn more. And then you realize how little you know.
Yeah.
And so your thought of how much you know drops way down. And so then suddenly it strikes most people like, oh my God, I don't know anything about this. And then only from that point can you start to build up like your proper knowledge.
Yeah.
And actually become an expert over time. I don't know. I'll have to show you a chart of it.
No,
but,
yeah.
But it's been studied formally and it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. So it's cool to keep in mind.
Yeah. I'm thinking of when I was out in Moab that all right, yeah, I know how to climb at this point. I'm pretty, you know, I've got this down. And then I get out to Moab and it's these splitter cracks in the desert that I've never experienced before. And like I start up it and I'm just like, wow, wait. I just learned a very valuable experience that I may know how to climb stuff with which I'm familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
On types of rock and in styles that, with which I'm familiar. But these splitter cracks are a whole new animal. Mm. And ever since then, I've been much more aware of how big my gap is in knowledge about climbing.
Oh, that's cool. So like now you've kind of reached that like low point.
I hope so.
And you can start building up.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a little bit of that when I went to Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
And I climbed, I think it was rated like a 5.6.
Yeah.
Which is like, I could just climb that in my sleep normally. But then it was on granite and it was like really slabby. And the way they bolt at Joshua Tree, there's like three bolts on a route. And so I'm standing there like looking down at potentially a 40-foot fall, and like just my fingers just wrapped around this tiny little piece of rock. I'm like, whoa, I never knew 5'6" could be so hard.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. That's when you start getting like the Elvis leg, they call it, or you start shaking and shake yourself right off the wall.
The sewing machine.
Luckily, I didn't fall, but I was in over my head on like something that would normally be very easy for me.
Yeah. Hmm.
I guess you could apply that kind of thing to travel too. Like,
absolutely.
You realize how little you know about the world when you start traveling to different places.
Yeah. And what may feel familiar, or what might sound familiar at first, once you start experiencing the local variation of it, can be quite different.
It's totally true. I know, especially if you come to somewhere like as different as China is, and just some, I mean, in some ways, like we're all humans and we all experience the same things. We all see the same reality.
Most of us.
Okay, I shouldn't say all. I know, you always do that. Like, I should qualify that, yeah. Most of us see the same things, and, you know, the stuff that's factually true is there. But there are some serious cultural differences that dictate how we view the world, how we walk through life and experience this life, which we experienced today on the wall a little bit.
Absolutely.
We ran into a more than one person, I think, playing music, and we were kind of relaxing on this old guard tower, just our little group, and this guy came up and blasting a Gangnam Style,
yeah. And then it switched, and then after that ended, it became a Chinese ballad.
Yeah.
He was singing along.
And we were trying to like talk about what to do next. And
it wasn't just he wasn't just playing the music. He had the walkie-talkie that kept crackling static.
Right. Like he probably had someone behind him.
And, yeah, there were a group that was spread out across the wall.
Yeah. And it's just Whoop-boom Gangnam Style.
And then he lights a cigarette. And then he
also the cigarette. Yeah. But I couldn't think. I'm like, we need to plan the rest of our day, and I cannot even think because this guy is here.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you asked him to turn it down. Like, I don't usually do that, but he did, and he was cool about it too.
Really cool.
Actually, he turned it off, and then he was not nearly as annoying once that music was turned off.
Yeah, actually, like once he turned the music off, we started talking for a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, but it was it's just completely normal to do that. And it drives me crazy, like,
right.
But it's just a cultural thing. It's normal to play music like that.
Yeah, like in America, we would expect people to have their earbuds in if they wanted to listen to music. It's an individual thing. It's your experience.
Right. It's not everybody's experience.
It's more of a social experience. It's a shared thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's something very important to learn about Eastern cultures. It's more about the social, like all of us, the whole group. Even if it means that one guy, against our will, is playing loud, obnoxious music. It's about the whole group experiencing this whole thing.
Yeah. there were multiple other people. There were other people on the wall, too, who were playing their music as they were going, dancing and singing along.
All right. One guy was very happy, dancing on this little pedestal on top of the wall and playing some loud music.
He had a lot of stoke. I'll give him that. He was stoked.
This guy, this thing maybe is like a newer phenomenon anyway, because like how long have these little speakers been out that are Bluetooth? And you can really play loud on these speakers. And, like, I know in the 80s you could carry a boombox on your shoulder, but you wouldn't go hiking all day with that.
Well, we did see the guys who hauled up that Pelican case with a drone in it.
Right.
That was bigger than a boombox.
But
not all day hiking,
Right. They just hauled it up to, like, where we're camping. But that was interesting, too. These guys flew over with a drone.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know. Are they pretty common in the U.S. now?
Drones are getting very common. They're toys now. Kids can buy toys. You can buy a toy drone for your kid with a camera on it that hooks to their iPhone. Yeah. They can control it. And most of the time, they just crash and get broken quite quickly. But, yeah, they're really common. And then you're seeing them more and more at outdoors, outdoor venues like parks and mm-hmm. such. Not one of my best friends. He's actually co-owner of a video production company in Madison, Wisconsin, and they. He uses drones a lot for his videography and some special shoots that they do, and he was the first and still the only licensed drone pilot who can fly over the Capitol building, apparently.
Oh, okay.
So there are more laws cropping up. Like,
there's actually airspace rules now.
Yeah, you can't fly it within a certain distance of the controlled airspace around an airfield, I think.
Yeah.
They're banned in federal parks without special permits. Hmm. But most states, including Wisconsin, they're allowed in state parks.
Oh, okay.
But if you're going to be flying them over groups of people or some public buildings or sensitive buildings, you need permits. And if you're going to be flying them within a certain distance of an airport,
okay,
you need a permit. There are all these laws popping up. But Amazon, I don't know if you've heard, Amazon's delivering packages by drone now.
I read they were going to do it. Yeah. They're starting that. Small tests.
And they have, and not just flying drones.
Yeah.
They're also experimenting with little rover drones. The little like RC cars type. Think of it like a box sitting on top of an RC chassis.
Huh.
And with a GPS navigation thing and a camera.
Wow.
And they're dropping. Yeah.
So that's really happening.
Little
now.
Rover drones.
It sounded like a joke when I first read it.
No, that's real.
Wow. I mean, when I first moved to China, or before that, I don't remember ever seeing a drone in the U.S. or even hearing about them. I can't even remember when I first heard about them, but
yeah.
That was only 3 years ago. I don't think I'd ever seen one. Then they I came home, and around the whole Capitol building, there's signs that say no drones.
Yeah.
Like, wow, sign of the times, huh?
Yeah. Apparently, the legislators get all worked up if they look up and see a drone. They think that it's somebody trying to get dirt on them or spying on them, trying to get video.
Automatically.
So they report them to the Capitol Police, and the Capitol Police go and try to find who's doing it.
Okay. Oh, that's true. You don't have to be really near your drone.
No. Some of them, you don't have to be line of sight.
Oh, right. If they use, like, a radio frequency. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, right. So, well, that's a little scary, actually. But it's another one of those things where I guess we have those hard laws concerning them, and it's kind of a gray area here.
Yeah,
I've heard you're not supposed to fly them over the Forbidden City, but beyond that, I don't know that there's many rules. Maybe there are, that I just don't know it. I've never really looked into getting one.
Yeah, like that'd be an interesting addition to your travel kit.
It'd take
a lot of space, and you got to.
Yeah.
The batteries don't last all that long. You got to charge, keep them charged.
Right. I did meet a guy who was traveling with one.
Really?
We actually recorded a podcast.
Yeah.
And he had an interesting story. He was flying his drone over Lake Baikal in Siberia.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to have this automatic mechanism that once the battery starts dying, it turns around and returns to where it started. But somehow the GPS in it screwed up, and it didn't return. It just kept going out further.
Yeah, flyaway, they call it.
Oh, that happens.
Yeah, it happens with alarming frequency, apparently there'll be a GPS error and it just doesn't know where it is. It just keeps flying on its last known trajectory.
They
call it a flyaway.
Well, he had a flyaway, that's for sure, right over Lake Baikal. And then he slowly watched as his drone just slowly went down and sank into the abyss of the deepest lake in the world.
Batteries are dying.
And he ran out and hired the nearest rowboat to take him out there and try to find it before it sank, but it was too late. Yeah. It was gone.
That's the other thing. Apparently insurance for the people who work in videography and have these drones, apparently the insurance costs more than the drone on an annual basis, or just about.
Whoa.
Because so many of them get lost or destroyed or damaged.
So there's a more than a 50, how would that work? Like, it's almost more likely than not that your drone's
going
to get...
It is definitely more likely than not that you're going to destroy your drone.
Within a year. Oh, well, they don't work so well then, do they?
pilot error, most of the time.
Okay.
Bodies of water tend to be particularly hazardous.
I guess so, yeah. Yes, as I've learned. Well, he came into China, though, and he, if I remember right, he got a new drone for free. Like, he had it insured.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And he was able to get, like, the next model or something. So it actually worked out really well for him.
Cool.
I don't know how much his policy cost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess maybe there's some kind of, like, chicken and egg problem there. Like, if you have the insurance policy, you're probably more likely to be reckless with it, you know?
That happens in insurance, yes.
Oh, maybe that's a common thing with insurance.
It is. It definitely is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm not likely to drive recklessly when I know, like, it's not about the car or whatever. It's about my life.
Yeah.
Just knowing that I'm insured. But I guess with it's stuff that you own,
you know,
you're not going to take care of it as well if you know that you can just get a new one.
I don't know if you remember this about, somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago, I think it was one of the major car manufacturers, GM or Ford or something, came out with an ad series of people destroying their trucks.
Oh, really?
So there's one where somebody accidentally looped a line that was for a ferry boat under the hitch of their truck, and it just ripped their truck off the dock and into the water. Huh. There's another one where, like, they didn't set a brake or something, or rolled off a cliff.
And there's videos of all these?
Yeah, like, okay. These were commercials that they were doing, and it ends with the new model of your truck is coming out, time to upgrade. And they're
encouraging this then.
Yeah.
Oh, so these weren't real incidents.
No.
These were, like, fake.
It was
fictionalized or whatever.
It was trying to put a humorous spin on, time to upgrade. You better go get that insurance money.
But it's a car company
It was a car company doing it. And they stopped running those ads because the insurance, from what I heard, there was a lot of blowback in the insurance industry. Like, this isn't funny. Like, people actually do this. Stop showing that ad.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Stop encouraging them to destroy their trucks.
Yeah.
Wow. Something I hadn't thought about. No, I never saw that one. I'll have to look for it. Yeah. Well, I'm starting to fade a little bit here.
So. Yeah. You could probably just edit out that last story. It's not very related.
No.
Wandering.
I've been liking this. I just hope the wind noise hasn't been too bad.
Sorry. I'm a little gassy from dinner.
right.
Well, when not we what first, you were talking about? Not that wind?
Oh, yeah, totally. No. when we first started recording, it was just completely still, and now the wind has really picked up.
Yeah.
But the night is very clear, and I'm gonna hit the hay here, maybe do some hiking tomorrow on the wall, and then you guys are going home in a couple days.
Right. Yeah. We leave on Sunday. When we arrive back home on Sunday.
Yeah.
Same time.
Yeah.
Same time.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Matthew, and I've really enjoyed having you here, and Jess too. It's been awesome, if for nothing else than to see old friends and, like, familiar faces, and show you guys a little bit of our life here.
Thank you, Dan. It's been really good catching up with you, man. I missed you guys back home.
Thanks to my guest, Matthew Clausen, for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. I'm going to put some photos up of our trek along the Great Wall on my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number, 1000daysbetween.com. And also on my website, you can get more information about this podcast and other episodes and all of the photos that I put up and all the stories that I put up. So, thanks again for all of your support, and I'll talk to you next time.